From Radio 720 WGN Chicago, this is Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg.
As I said a moment ago in my pre-introduction to the program, we are tonight going to be talking about and listening to the man whom I consider, and I think my guest, Eugene Bergman, also considers the single greatest broadcaster in the history of American radio, Gene Shepherd. Eugene Bergman is the author of a new book titled Excelsior, You Fat Egg, and that needs explanation, which we'll get in a moment. Subtitle, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepherd. Have I overstated the case when I say the single greatest talent in the history of American radio?
A lot of people would agree with that, and I certainly do. I think he was a great innovator. I think that the people around today who talk on the radio, whether they know it or not, are descendants of what he initiated.
Yet our problem tonight is that for our standard Chicago and Midwestern audience, even if they're old enough to have been listening to the radio from 1955 through, say, 1970, which were the major years, or 1955 to 75, which were the years of Shepherd's great and dominant presence in American radio, but most of our listeners, even if old enough, would not have heard him if they lived in the Midwest all those years.
No, that's because he was on WOR in New York, which was a 50,000-watt clear-channel radio station, but it only reached roughly 28 states along the East. There was some pirating of his shows. There were some attempts at syndication, but not the kind of syndication we know of today.
We could try to define what he did that was so special, and we'll talk about that shortly, but I want to plunge right in and introduce Gene Shepherd to our audience. And the one we're going to start with, these are clips that you've made available to us, is the one titled Hurling an Invective. This goes back to 1957. Do you want to explain what we're going to hear?
One of the things that Shepherd liked to do from time to time, especially in those early days in the 50s, was to, shall we say, startle the uninitiated out there in the dark by having his listeners put their radios face outward into the night on the windowsill, and then all of a sudden come out with some outrageous and startling saying that all the neighbors would say, "What was that? What's going on out there?"
This was a nonstop talker. He talked brilliantly, easily, colloquially, with wonderful metaphors, with surprising turns of idea and turns of phrase. And here he is doing that as he's preparing his audience to hurl a particular invective on this one night.
Can't speak in WOR, looking at it realistically, has realized that we must, nay, indeed, all of us, you must have an outlet. You must be able to, from time to time, tell them what it's all about. Give it to them. Don't stand still for nobody. Once again, the science of electronics brings deeper and richer meaning to your life. Put your radio on the windowsill. In an unprecedented act of goodwill, gorgeous listenership, and realization of its deep responsibilities as a purveyor of public good, WOR makes this service available to you exclusively. This is the only station where you'll find an outlet for your aggression. You'll find expressions for your repressions. Put your radio on the windowsill now. Do it now. Now. With the loudspeaker pointed out towards the neighborhood. You know that crowd out there. You know that gang. Don't you do? Put it out there. That's it. And I'll give you a cue. And the WOR Public Service Department stands behind you, it's okay. Nobody will be able to trace it to you. We have a special, non-trivial voice which we use on this particular invective. All right, it will not sound like any living being any resemblance to anyone alive at this time is purely coincidental and does not, of course, include you, since you are obviously not coincidental, nor the result of forces beyond all comprehension. Millions of tiny forces have led you to this point. Coincidences here and there, yes, but they've all fallen into a pattern, and here you are now. So you're off the hook. This voice will carry your sentiments, your repressions, your aggressions into the darkness out there, that voice with a lion, those sharks of you. With your friends, yeah, your friends. They're your friends, all right. They're your friends. Anytime I really need them, you know what's going to happen, of course. All right. Get your radio on the windowsill and point it outwards, and I'll give you the cue. And when I give you the cue, turn that radio up as loudly as it'll go. We're going to use a very special kind of invective tonight. This is known as the disquieting with a touch of morbid curiosity type, which is type 23A and a very difficult type to use. You can drop out now if you feel it's a little too strong. Let's see. Yeah, already? Okay. Radio on windowsill now.
Come home drunk again. What about the kids? What about the kids? I asked you. How long is this going to go on? How long?
Okay, get that radio back in now, fast. This is the Martin Block program. It's time for a make-believe pool room, friends. There's time to pick up your shoes. Time to step over the table and knock off a game of make-believe snooker. And now on table seven.
At the very end, we'll have to explain. Probably the most popular program in New York at the time was Martin Block's make-believe ballroom on a station, I think, called WNEW.
I believe it was, yes. And so it played popular music.
That's what he's fooling around with at the very end. But what a wonderful invention. What an easy, glib talking. What a wonderful fantast this guy was. And this is a typical piece, but there are thousands of such pieces that he did.
21 years and more, yeah. on New York radio, some of it overnight, some of it Sunday nights from 9 to 1, and almost 20 years of 45-minute programs, five nights a week.
And one of his many features was hurling invective, wasn't it?
Yes, especially in the early days.
What were some of the other invectives that he hurled through the radio's place to us? At the window. And probably thousands of listeners did place the radios at the window, did they?
Yes. In fact, some listeners would hear other people's loudspeakers blaring out into the night. One of the things he said was, "You don't think for a moment you're fooling anyone, do you?" That was in 1957. Another one is, "How long do you think you can get away with this? The jig is up." And on and on and on.
Who was this masked man?
This masked man?
Well, I'm remembering the Lone Ranger in this, remember? Who was that masked man? Since we're talking about old-time radio. But who was Gene Shepard?
Who was Gene Shepard? He was a guy who was absolutely obsessed with talk. And the fascinating thing about him is that he was very much involved in the jazz scene, and his style of talk was improvisation. It was extemporaneous. He never had a script.
So he was running a riff on the air, just
yes.
As his jazz musicians would do.
Yes.
In the clubs in the village that he frequented regularly.
Yes, and of course there was a lot of improvisation going on at that time in the 50s. There were people like Jack Kerouac who were just writing on on rolls of paper, and there was Jackson Pollock, who was doing his drip paintings. There were improvisational groups coming out of Chicago, the Compass players and several others who were doing improvisational bits.
That was Elaine May and...
Mike Nichols.
And Mike Nichols from the University of Chicago, originally.
Yes, and Shelley Berman.
Yeah.
A few others.
One thing we should point out to our Midwestern listeners is that though they didn't hear Gene Shepherd regularly, he was a local boy. He came from these very precincts, didn't he?
Yes, he was born in Chicago, and as a very young fellow, the family moved across the border to Hammond, Indiana, where he basically grew up.
And Hammond and memories of life in Hammond figures very prominently in some of his soliloquy.
Yes, he told many, many stories about being a kid in Hammond and what it was like to grow up in the Midwest. And he had a Midwest sense of humor.
He did, indeed. Of course, some of our listeners will know his work, not from the programs that ran for some 20 or 22 years on WOR, a leading station in New York City, but rather from some of his later work on television.
Yes, he did a number of things, such as a series called Gene Shepherd's America, for example. One of the interesting things about that was that it was a time when television equipment was getting very lightweight and portable.
Mm-hmm.
And because of his interest in improvisation, he said, let's take some of this lightweight equipment and just go out around the country and explore this vast country that has so many fascinating little bits and details and quirky bits about it. And he just went all over the place and improvised on television. So that was rather extraordinary to do.
And then there's that Christmas piece of his, which is very popular and is still played and replayed around Christmas time.
Yes, in fact, it's played 24 hours straight starting at Christmas Eve. It's called A Christmas Story, and many people think of it nostalgically. Oh, the great old days of growing up in the 30s and 40s. And it does have its nostalgic aspects, but yet it's absolutely hilarious, and each little incident in it may have its nostalgic bit and aspect, but really you see that everything that happens ends in disaster. So it's not exactly nostalgia the way we think of it.
Well, his monologues were full of personal recollection. They were full of autobiographical material, but much of it, of course, was artistically restructured, maybe using some elements from his actual history, but much of it really pure invention, I gather.
Yes, in fact, he would tell it in a way that it seemed to most listeners as though this were purely the truth of his remembering his childhood. On the other hand, he later would say, no, I made all this stuff up. There weren't even people with those names. Well, now we know there were people with those names, but we really don't know in terms of the details what was really true and what he had made up.
Now, to get a further sense of the style in which he did his broadcasting, the spontaneity, the manic excitement, at the same time, the easy fluency, the absolutely unruffled quality of it all, we'll go to another cut. And this, I think, is the beginning of a program which ran probably for over an hour. And he's shifting from one subject to another. We hear also at the very opening his standard music. Bonfire, what was that?
Well, this was a piece of music that is very exciting, full orchestral music. It sounds a lot like the Lone Ranger's William Tell Overture. But he liked it because, as he put it, it was pure glop. He thought it was so bad it was fascinating. And so he played it for 21 years at the beginning and ending of almost every program.
So here's the program at the beginning. We go some 4 or 5 minutes. into the program. You have any idea when this date's from?
I'm not sure which one you got.
Number four on
there.
Your list.
Let me see.
Must be in the 1950s, still.
I think this would have been the very late 50s, possibly early 50s.
Gene Shepherd, WOR, New York, in the late 50s.
Oh, wow. At least I'm back. You know, this is terrible. I'm still so shaken by this whole thing that I hope we've already got a few advance reports. Please do not call them into the station here because for some reason or other, our entire switchboard system has been, it's been just knocked completely out of kilter. So perhaps this, could have some kind of electronic ramifications that we don't even know yet about. There's all kinds of scientists not calling around here. And we would like to hear... what actually occurred in your area. We have one report, which I do not credit, that a young man was listening to the, just before the news when we did the scientific experiment with the Dyak curse. A young man was listening in, I believe the town was West Orange. Is there such a town as West Orange, New Jersey? Well, he was listening in West Orange. His father demanded that he turn this jazz off, which is the way it was put. The old man apparently used his own nomenclature to describe the show. He said, turn that jazz off. And the kid got into an argument with the old man, and before they could get to the radio, both of them fled the house screaming, trailing smoke. We don't know what the further ramifications have been. We'd just like to know. We've got to clear the air. It's just too much. You get too close to the primal guts of life. You got to clear the air. Would you please help me clear the air there, Mario? Please, bring it on.
Keep your old nose down, keep your feet up. Oh, lucky Lindsay. Keep an eye on the track. Watch out, yeah. Look out for that old red flag. Oh,
Saves the day, I'll tell you. I just like to clear the air, I'm going to say one thing, though. A lot of you, I'm sure there's a lot of skeptics out there. And I suppose if you've never had any experience with the supernatural, you tend to be skeptical about it. I'm sure, there's no question about that. But I think it goes back to the experiences that you have as a kid with this kind of thing. You used to... The only reason I ever talk about being a kid is not because, it's not nostalgia, you weren't great being a kid and all that jazz. Because any legitimate walking around certified kid, you just stop any walking around certified guaranteed kid, and you ask them what it's like being a kid, and you'll get the straight dope. I mean, it's like a kick you in the kneecap.
So don't come around with this jazz, you know, how great it was. Ah, come on. It's not great being a kid. This is just a fact. It is not. It is not great not being a kid. In fact, let's put it this way. It's not great being anything, really. You really boil it right down to the... The only reason I ever talk about this being a kid, because, you know, this isn't the time, this is the moment in your life when you're beginning to absorb all these various experiences and you begin to know what the world is about. Now, some people, luckily, have been shielded in polyethylene from the time that we're born, so they can grow up to be big, fat, old 75-year-old guys with beards and still not know which end is up. Literally, and figuratively, and actually not which end is up. You know, you see them walking down the street once in a while on their hands. They don't know, you know. They never learned that it was the feet that you're supposed to walk on. So I'm a little bit nervous about this thing we just went through. Now, I'll give you a little, again, I must say, this show is not for the squeamish. This program tonight is not for the faint-hearted. It's not for those of you who, you know, who, oh, yes, we constantly get others continually saying, well, Mr. Shepherd, I can't understand why there are so many nice people on your station, and you have to say such, well, such bad things all the time. Well, I don't know. I just don't know why that is, madam. I'm going to try hard, but it never works out. But nevertheless, I'm a kid, you know, and the little news item came in the other night. Little thing here from Southbridge, Massachusetts. That I'm not even going to read it to you because it's liable to scare a few of you, too. It's cold out, right? It's cold out. Right here. Okay. Now, by cold, I mean any time it gets below freezing. It's cold enough for the curse I'm going to talk about. It's cold out, huh? Well, me and Schwartz, Flick and Bruner, they're walking around, scratching. In every crowd, you take four people, you're going to find three believers and one skeptic. Now, it is believed in our day and age, because we've got some interesting philosophical hookers going with us these days, that anybody who does not believe in a crowd is automatically right. Just like we like to believe today that anybody who is the center, because he isn't the center, is right. Well, this is a questionable thesis. There's been some great dissenters of the past that could disprove this thesis to hell and gone, if you'll excuse the expression. Among them, you know that Hitler was a great dissenter from the morality code of his time. You know, oh, wow. But that, nevertheless, that's neither here nor there. I'm a kid, you know, me and Schwartz and Flick and Toner. And, Bruner was a true believer. I mean, there's always one kid in every crowd, or one man in every crowd, says, yeah, 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 that's right. Yes, sir, J.B. Absolutely. Yeah. Please tell me the joke again, boss. It's funnier every time you tell it. It's 34 times. All right, very good. Well, that's the Bruner type. And then, of course, there was the Schwartz type, who was not really a believer, but used to just be very silently waiting to see which way the wind was going to blow. And if the wind blew west, he went west. If the wind blew east, he went east. But that didn't mean that he believed in east or west. He always waited to see which way the crowd was going. And then there was me. I was the patsy of the crowd. There's always one guy in every crowd, believe me, friends, who's the patsy. You know what is it, a patsy? Well, a patsy is the guy who fills out the coupon and gets shucked. The patsy is the guy who says, gee, that's a great idea. I'll try it first. Well, I was the patsy. Flick was the skeptic. Flick was always about 6 months ahead of us, and Flick was always on top of everything. A skeptic. Well, one day, the wind is blowing out of the cold, frozen north, and we're struggling on our way to school. Me and Schwartz and Flick and Bruner wearing our sheepskin coats, wearing our helmets with the goggles. The snow is up to our you-know-what, and we're struggling on our way towards the Warren G. Harding School when one of those perennial kid myths was brought up. Now, the idea of a believer and a non-believer almost always has to do with mythology. It doesn't do you any good to believe that today is not Tuesday when it's Wednesday. But it's not mythology. You're just lousing up on a fact. That's all. A believer has to do with mythology. For example, there is one mythology that feels that man is basically a beautiful creature, designed, built, and born in beauty.
And where he's going with this, our listeners will not know. Let them get their hands on the whole thing. But what a fabulous talker. He's really very much like that incredible guy you run into one night at the bar, who just holds everybody in fascination as he goes on for hours, free associating from story to characterization to attitude back to another story and so on. This was a run-on talker who could hold your interest forever.
Yes, and he was that way on the radio, and he was that way off. I spoke with a number of people who knew him who said that he never stopped talking. You could not get him to stop talking. Even if he ran into somebody he'd never met before, he would corner them and give them a 45-minute monologue. And then when he went home, at the end of the day after doing his radio program, he was a ham radio operator, and he would talk on ham radio into the night. He was obsessed with talk.
He appears in New York in 55, is that right?
Yeah.
He earlier done a stint in Cincinnati, I think.
And also in Philadelphia.
And in Philadelphia. He had come to those places after the war. He served in the war.
Yes, in the Signal Corps in the States.
He was born in 1921.
Yeah.
You have determined. And reaches New York at 55 and starts doing this stuff on WOR. Is there an immediate positive response from the New York audience?
There was an immediate response from the what he called the night people.
Yeah.
People who were up late at night for whatever reasons. They simply felt more comfortable in the dark when things were moving at a slower pace, where you could be more contemplative. Of course, this would include jazz musicians, creators in all fields, writers, painters, and, of course, some students. And they would be fascinated by this slow-moving but really mind-tickling kind of monologue where he drew you in. It was almost as though it was a dialogue between you, between the listener and you. But he was the only one talking.
It was very intimate, wasn't it?
It was extremely intimate. You felt that he was your closest friend and he was exploring with you the fascinating life, intelligent life in all fields.
I think you're describing just how you felt about him when you first encountered him on the air.
Yes, I first started listening as a college sophomore. And as soon as I heard him, I started recording him because I indeed felt that he and I were in tune, you might say.
You met him only once or was it twice?
Well, once I talked for a few seconds on the phone with him, but then once I met him when he asked some of his listeners to gather in a bookstore, and we eventually went to an automat where he signed a copy of the book that he perpetrated the hoax about, called I, Libertine, a hoax about a book that didn't exist. Fascinating story.
He got his listeners to go demanding a book in bookstores whose title he had invented.
Yes.
And then later on he followed through and produced that book, had a lot of people write that book for him.
Yes, eventually Ian Ballantyne of Ballantyne Books got Shepard together with science fiction writer Theodore Sturgeon, and they churned out the book very, very quickly because it had become somewhat of a a news story about this book that nobody could find, but yet everyone was asking for, and some people claim they read.
And it was in the genre of the sort of the bodice ripper gothic novel. Was that the idea?
Exactly. 18th century erotica.
Yes.
And the story is that the Sturgeon turned out the book in roughly 3 weeks, but he fell asleep before he could finish the last chapter. So Ballantyne's wife, who was an editor, says that she wrote the last chapter.
Now, he was responsible for another book where a different each chapter was written by a different writer.
No, I'm not familiar with that.
I may be thinking of something else. But be that as it may, a fascinating guy. What do we really know about who he was and how he came to all of this?
Well, we know certain basics about his biography. But one of the things that he did, despite the fact that on the radio he gave the impression that he was telling you all about himself, the reality is he was hiding most of his real life from everybody, not only from his listeners, but from his wives and everyone else.
His wives? How many were there?
There were four. There was a very short-term marriage. And then there was a marriage to Joan Warner, who was the mother of his two children, Randall Shepherd and Adrian Shepherd.
Mm-hmm.
Then he was married to the actress Lois Nettleton for about 6 or 7 years. And finally, he was married for about 21 years to his producer, who was also his editor, his helper in all phases of his life and work.
What was the radio scene like, the radio scene into which he suddenly came?
Before
the radio, local radio, New York radio, to be sure, in the 1950s.
One of the most powerful stations was WOR, and they were called the Talk of New York.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because during the day, they had a number of people on, such as Dorothy Kilgallen and Dick Calmer, man and wife. They had the Fitzgeralds. They had the McCanns. There were three generations of a man named Gambling. Now, these were all what I call chatters. They chatted. They didn't really talk in the same way that Shepherd did.
They were not yet doing the stuff that Talk Radio has been doing now for many years, for decades, namely interaction with listeners over telephone.
No, they didn't really do that, although in the 60s, some of that kind of call-in was beginning to come on strong.
Actually, there was a man here in Chicago who was broadcasting here when I first came to Chicago in 65, Jack Eigen, who claimed and who did a talk show with some call-ins on WMAQ, I believe, who claimed that he had invented the call-in program.
Well, one of the interesting things is that there is a claim that one of the first call-ins was Lois Nettleton, who was then Gene Shepherd's girlfriend, who he asked for a listener to call in. She called in. They had a very interesting conversation over the air, and from time to time she would call in more and more, and she became known as the listener.
Yeah.
And there are people who claim that that was indeed just about the first call-in.
You know, another fascinating radio performer who, I don't know whether he was contemporary with Shepherd or came a little later or a little earlier, but I think he was on WOR, was Henry Morgan. You remember Henry Morgan?
Yes. In fact, he started quite a few years before Shepherd.
That was before.
Yes. He was broadcasting in the 40s.
Also a comedic talker.
Yes. And he had a very acerbic wit.
Yeah. Very dry.
And I'd say that he gave the impression that he was somebody's really clever uncle or clever cousin who could come out with the wisecrack.
I've heard some of the recordings of Morgan, and he was really quite a fine performer.
Yes.
And quite a wit. They're not the same, but they're both quite good doing what they did. We'll hear more, Shepard. We'll talk more about radio and its evolution from then to now. And we'll talk more about the life and times of Gene Shepard. A rather interesting and surprising story, as developed by Eugene Bergman in his new his new biography, Excelsior, You Fathead, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepard. We haven't yet explained the title, Excelsior, You Fathead, but we will directly after we pause for an update on the evening's news from Paula Cooper.
From Radio 720, WGN Chicago, this is Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg.
And we come back to Eugene B. Bergman, author of Excelsior, You Fathead, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepard, just published this fine and fascinating biography by Applause Books. So, it's time to explain. What does that mean, Excelsior, You Fathead?
Excelsior is a Latin term that means generally onward and
mm-hmm.
upward,
yes.
Let's say to victory, which is a very positive, idealistic idea. And, of course, You Fathead means you fool. So this rather incorporates the two aspects of Gene Shepard's philosophy. That is, sure, have fun, attempt to do everything you can in life, have a great joy in it, try to achieve goals. But if you're too idealistic and you don't have a good amount of realism behind your actions, you are a fool. So that was his most well-known phrase. And it, as I say, it captures much of what he felt.
Do you know the poem by Longfellow titled Excelsior?
Well, I have it in the book, and I've read it many times.
The shades of night were falling fast as through an alpine village passed a youth who bore amid snow and ice a banner with a strange device,
Excelsior.
His brow was sad, his eye beneath flashed like a falcon from its sheath, and like a silver clarion rung the accents of that unknown tongue, Excelsior. And so on and so on for many long stanzas. And the last one, there in the twilight cold and gray, lifeless but beautiful he lay, and from the sky, serene and far, a voice fell like a falling star.
Excelsior. And that's about a young idealistic man who goes up into a blizzard,
yeah,
up a mountain.
Climbing a mountain.
Despite the fact that everyone is saying, oh, no, don't do it, don't do it. And he says, oh, I must, Excelsior. And of course, they find him dead in the snow the next day.
This was a wonderfully rich mind, the mind of Gene Shepard, attached to a very loquacious tongue. What was his education? Or what were the formative experiences? What filled his sensorium and perceptorium?
Well, he grew up, as we've said, in Hammond, Indiana. And by the time he graduated from high school, he had the feeling that he had to get out of Hammond, and he had to eventually get to New York, which at the time was the intellectual and creative capital of not only this country, but probably the world. That's New York in the 50s. So after he got out of the Army, he went through a number of small radio stations and then larger ones in Cincinnati and Philadelphia, apparently always with the idea that he had to somehow get to New York.
Does one understand that he had no formal education beyond high school?
He claimed sometimes that he had a college degree. That has not been substantiated.
Uh-huh.
Apparently, he took some courses, and that was about it.
Must have read very widely.
He read very widely. He could talk about just about any subject you named. And, of course, he would bring up anything from haiku to the great philosophers and the great novelists and so on.
You know, for older folks remembering American radio, there was a figure in Chicago very different in mode and in mood. But on the air, maybe at roughly the same time, he went on to national prominence. But he also was a great, fascinating spieler. He could talk and talk and talk. In the late, in the midnight hours. And that is, what was his name? I'm about to say what was his name, but it comes to me even as I said that. That was Dave Garraway.
I have seen some of Dave Garraway on television, but I'm not familiar enough with
him.
Well,
on television, he did a television show, I gather, from Chicago, which was local. But he was on WMAQ radio for many years. Towards midnight, he would play some music, but he would talk in long, long stretches, pre-associating and displaying considerable knowledge about things and somehow conveying interesting attitudes and a certain amount of world weariness, a certain amount of cynicism, at the same time, a considerable comedic structure to his thought. When he finally went to New York, he became the host of the program that is still seen on NBC television in the morning, whatever they call it.
The Today Show.
And there he had a very different function, of course, and wasn't spieling away the way he did on the air. But I would say that on air, he was a Midwestern equivalent, though not as long-lasting on radio, as the Midwestern equivalent of Gene Shepherd.
It certainly does seem that way, yes.
Yeah. I wonder when we go to the phones tonight, as we will, whether any of our listeners, particularly some of the older folks in their 60s and beyond, remember Garraway on the air, and certainly we'd be delighted if there are any listeners who remember Gene Shepherd on the air. Perhaps they listened to them when they were younger people in the East before they came Midwest. Though he is known, as we said earlier, to the country generally for some of those later films that he did, mostly for PBS television, I think.
Yes, he did a number of long-form films that were really based on his short stories. They would combine three or four or five into an hour and a half PBS.
What are some of the titles of those?
Phantom of the Open Hearth was one.
Uh-huh.
The Great American Fourth of July was another one. Star-Crossed Romance of Josephine Kosnowski was another one. He had uh-huh. these marvelous titles
yeah.
for his short stories.
What happened to Josephine Kosnowski?
She was a voluptuous young Polish girl who moved in next door to Ralph Parker, who was the Gene Shepherd persona.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, he was fascinated by her. But what he found out was that her family was looking to an eventual marriage, and all he was looking for was a nice hug and a kiss from Josephine Kosnowski. And he found that it was a little bit too early in life to get involved in something so serious, and he just runs away. He escapes.
Uh-huh. Do we know what happened to Josephine beyond that?
No, that was not of interest to Shepherd. He was only interested in what happened to his own persona.
Let's hear another monologue, as it were. They're all monologues, of course. And here's one that I hadn't heard before. I listened to it earlier today on the CD that you worked up for this material. This is the one about the Moni sign. Do we need to explain this, or should we just plunge
into
it?
Well, I think we should. There's a building, a very tall building in New York. It's Mutual of New York. So the sign is M-O-N-Y.
Yeah. That's it.
That's it.
And here's Shepherd responding to it.
Let's see. I'm walking along. I'm just paying attention only to my own worries. I'm walking along on 16th Street the other day. And reading signs. There are those of us who read signs, and then there are those who apparently never see this world around us. One of the most significant signs here in New York is a sign that flashes M-O-N-Y. Off and on, M-O-N-Y. Do you know that I was in New York for over 3 months before I realized that that wasn't a misspelling?
I'm just, true. I had no idea what this meant. And I just thought, well, it's New York, you know? And I used to walk up and down Broadway at 2 o'clock in the morning, and that thing would go M-O-N-Y. I said, why didn't somebody get that thing fixed? This is beginning to bug me. M-O-N-Y. M-O-N-Y. It would just flash. And then it would go M-O-N-Y. 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 And underneath it, it would say, 314. 315. M-O-N-Y. And then it would be a little yellow pole or something. And it would be a green star at the top. M-O-N-Y. And I'm walking along Broadway trying to figure out why aren't they getting that thing fixed? Everybody is seeing all over town this misspelling. This is awful. So either you look at it or you don't. You know, I find that most people don't, and those who don't always figure that those who do are a little bit out of their mind. What is your man speaking about? Well, I'm walking along 16th Street the other day. Madam, how do you feel this one? I'm walking along 16th Street on the west side, and I notice into one of the doorways, you know, there's a little ante room or the lobby into one of these office buildings where there's the automatic elevator that goes up and down, and there's this big directory hanging in there with all the little white letters, and it tells where everything is. And then there's usually two or three big signs that say barber shop to the right or coffee shop to the left, or there's an arrow that points and says telephones that way. Has it ever occurred to you that one of the major industries of New York is telephoning? Honestly, it really is. One of the major industries here in New York City is just plain telephoning. I don't mean getting anything done about it. I mean just telephoning. There's always a line of people standing in front of a telephone booth telephoning. If you could somehow get a corner on that market, if you could collect 1 cent on every one of these don't worry, somebody is. Excuse me, madam. I can't help it, you know. Don't feel sorry for the phone company.
That little itchy bitsy pink phones now that light up in the dark.
I could see Wallace Beery. He rushes into this room to make a phone call. Some disaster has happened, and he grabs a hold of this little itchy bitsy, this little Jonquil yellow phone, the one that lights up in the dark. He's trying to dial it, and his finger can't fit into the.
Come on, man! Come on, now! Come on, man! What's the matter with this phone?
And his finger is caught in the dial. Excuse me, man. So I'm walking along 16th Street, and I look at them. There's a big sign that says coffee shop, and there's another big sign that says barber shop that way. And then above it, there's a sign that says the Margaret Sanger Bureau. And there's a great big blue and white sign, and all it says is fertility, one flight up. Well, I saw that one, and I walked on a little ways, and then this was beginning to soak down into my consciousness. You're going to understand the nature of our fears. Who would like to shoot an arrow into the air with me? I mean, you know, not worry much about where it lands. You know, just whoosh, up it goes. M-O-N-Y. 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 316. Well, I suspect, though, however, that these are the little secrets. Speaking of secrets, we have with us today the Village Voice.
The Village Voice, of course, was a newspaper. It still is a newspaper. He started doing a column for them, I think, didn't he?
He was one of the earliest people who wrote for the Village Voice. And he eventually was writing weekly columns. And, in fact, he helped promote the Voice when it was in serious financial straits. And he managed to help it survive.
You know, listening to that last clip, the thoughts that were running through my mind were, could anyone in radio today do that sort of thing? a straight soliloquy or a monologue. It should be made clear he didn't write this stuff. This was really free, associative, and spontaneous as it flowed from his mind and as it was conveyed in just a wonderfully articulate, colorful speech which held people listening for an hour, for 2 hours, for 3 hours. One of his programs, the nighttime one, ran for some 3 or 4 hours, did it not?
When he began these programs in 1956, he was broadcasting every day of, during the week from 1 in the morning till 5:30.
And it was a straight stream of consciousness,
yes,
soliloquy of this sort.
Yes.
Relieved by no phone calls.
No.
So maybe later his wife-to-be started calling a little bit.
Occasionally, but
yeah,
you could not say that he did a telephone call-in show.
Now, I've been doing radio for over 30 years, which is an embarrassing confession, virtually, and I still enjoy doing it. From the beginning, I've been talking with guests rather than doing what he does, and then we've been going to phones, as we will do in a while on this very program tonight. And I might as well, at this point, invite telephone callers. The number, of course, is 591-7200. If you want to talk about radio as it was then and about this particular genius, Gene Shepherd, or other geniuses you want to remember and brag about, give us a call, 591-7200. But I wouldn't say that having a guest here, like you right now, is a crutch, or having phone callers is a crutch, but I know that I could not get on the air for an hour and talk a lot, and talk, and just talk, and talk, and talk, and talk. At least I'd need phone input. On the occasional rare nights when I go without a guest, I will usually opine a bit on some public issue or read something from one or another opinion column and then invite callers to respond to it. I don't know anybody in American radio these days who does or tries to do, aspires to do, what Shepherd did apparently so effortlessly.
I really doubt that anyone else could do this. I think he was unique. I said, he did this 24 hours a day. It wasn't just on the radio. You couldn't stop him from talking. He was obsessed with the sound of his own voice. Sort of narcissistic, egotistic, true, but a genius in being able to pull this off.
I knew a guy once, all of Chicago knew him, who had this capacity when he was in the mood. He didn't do it on the air. He did it with friends. He often did it when there was a little bit of alcohol in him, just enough to kind of free him from, if not his ambitions, at least his otherwise light, surly attitude towards the world. The man I'm talking about is very well known. He died a few years ago, far too young. Mike Loyko, who was a great columnist. But at parties or at events with friends, after one or two libations, he would begin telling stories and expressing his views. I walked into one particular thing on a late afternoon many years ago, and Mike was there. And when I walked in, he was talking. And everyone was spellbound by the narrative of the commentary, by the wonderful indirect expression of contempt, as usual, for politicians and for other corrupt people. And it just went forward and flowed so easily. And after an hour and a half, I realized I was still sitting there listening to Mike Loyko. We all were. Now, that's the equivalent experience. We occasionally run into people who can do that privately, but they don't do it on the air routinely.
Right. They, I don't know of anyone else who ever did anything whatsoever like that. Explain it. Maybe one more enigma. I don't know that you can explain such a thing other than passion, ego, and extraordinary unique ability. I don't know how else to put it.
Well, you do subtitle your book "The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepherd."
Yes. He gave part of the reason for that is that he gave the sense that he was having such an intimate conversation with you and telling you the truth about himself. But as we found out, much of what he told was total fiction in terms of his storytelling. And in fact, he kept most of his private life to himself. And this is a very strange contradiction.
Mm-hmm. I note that we are loaded with phone calls, and all of the people who are calling did listen to Shep and have strong memories and great persisting enthusiasm for him, I gather. We'll pause for some overdue commercials, and then we'll let some of those Shep fans into this conversation between two old Shep fans. We return right after these words.
Hey, Stephanie, what's new?
My Ontario Place condo.
Your Ontario Place condo?
Mm-hmm. I bought an amazing American Invesco condo at the private residences at Ontario Place. It's right in the heart of River North at Ontario and State. Close to everything. Shopping, restaurants, nightlife, theaters, art galleries.
Really? That sounds great.
It's actually more than great. I've got huge space, tons of closet space, floor-to-ceiling windows, and every home has an oversized private balcony.
Your own balcony? I'd love my own balcony.
Plus, there's a health club and wellness center, rooftop pool and garden, business center. They have indoor parking, a White Hen, and even a Chili's restaurant right within my building.
Wow, that's awesome. You know, I've been looking for a new place, too, but I just haven't come across one that offers all that.
Well, you should call the American Invesco Sales Center at 312-640-1310. Or better yet, walk over with me right now to 10 East Ontario, and you can see for yourself. You'll love this place.
Meet Steve Cochran at a private Ontario place, May 26th. See the sponsor page at WGNradio.com. Legends exceed expectations. Because right now, when you join our Winner Circle Players Club, you can scratch to win up to $10,000 or choose a guaranteed $25. That means new members have a chance to go home with $10,000 just for joining the best players club in the business. And of course, members receive points redeemable for same-day cash, as well as generous comps to our award-winning restaurant. Because if there's one thing Jack Benyon knows, it's how to treat gamblers.
We give you more, and that's how it's always going
to
be.
So join the Winner Circle, and you can scratch to win up to $10,000 or choose a guaranteed $25. Jack Benyon's Horseshoe Casino Hammond, the closest casino to Chicago, Baker Skyway to Indianapolis Boulevard. Just call 1-866-711-SHOE for details.
Of course, who cares? So play for fun and play responsibly. And if you need help quitting, call 1-800-9-WITH-IT.
It's time for Customize Your Cobalt. Brought to you by your participating Chicagoland and Northwest Indiana Chevy dealer. Now when you purchase or lease a 2005 Chevy Cobalt, you get a $250 allowance towards GM accessories of your choice. Trick one out and customize your Cobalt into a tenacious tuner. Residency restrictions apply. See dealer for details. Take delivery by 5/31/05. Plus, now qualified lessees can choose to lease a sporty new 2005 Chevy Cobalt coupe or four-door sedan for around $159 a month with a 36-month lease and $1,334 due at site. Includes security deposit and all applicable offers, tax title, license, and dealer fees. Extra year payments may vary. Call 1-800-950-CHEV for important lease details. That's a 2005 Chevy Cobalt with a $250 allowance towards GM accessories of your choice, now for around $159 a month. Cobalt, the new commotion in the Chevy family. Join the revolution at your Chicagoland and Northwest Indiana Chevy dealer.
By the way, thanks for helping me move these boxes.
No problem.
Oh.
Hey, go ahead, put another one.
Okay, but careful others. Oh, you can't even see.
Hey, you leave that to me. Just tell me when I'm getting close.
You're close.
People don't always use common sense. Fortunately, there's a healthcare company that does, United Healthcare, offering health planning tools to fight rising costs, a 24-hour nurse line, and preventive healthcare solutions. United Healthcare. It just makes sense.
We now return to Extension 720. Once again, here's Milt Rosenberg.
I should make utterly clear something I have not stressed tonight so far, namely that the fine book by Eugene B. Bergman, Excelsior, You Fathead, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepard, is a very rich compendium, not merely of what we know about Gene Shepard, who remains as such mysterious in terms of the details of his life, but also of his achievements, and there's a vast amount of his material, which is reproduced in written form. It's not quite the same as hearing the voice, but having heard some of the voice tonight, you can almost imagine the performances. What is available, and that book, by the way, Excelsior, You Fathead, published by Applause Books, what's available in recording?
There are literally hundreds and hundreds of his shows available. there.
Commercially?
Yes. There are people who sell them. You can find them on eBay.
Uh-huh.
There is somebody who actually gives away CDs of Gene Shepherd material. And most of these people and most of these sources are available on the main Gene Shepherd website, which is flicklives.com. If you go to that site, you find a tremendous amount of material about Gene Shepherd in all aspects of his life and work, and also these various sources of his program.
Flicklives.com.
Yes.
We go to the phones now, 591-7200. You are on the air. Good evening.
Hi, Milt Barry Kaufman.
How are you, sir?
I am fine.
Barry Kaufman of WBBM.
That's right.
Dr. Barry
Kaufman. Dr. Barry Kaufman, right. 30 years on the radio and television, and a lot of that I owe to Gene Shepherd.
How so?
I was 14 years old in Teaneck, New Jersey, when he started in 55.
Huh.
And I still don't sleep at night. I stay up most of the night. A few friends and I just had our psyches molded by Shepherd.
What was the nature of his influence upon you?
The love of painting pictures with words.
Uh-huh.
You know, just staring at a ceiling with a little bit of light coming through a window and hearing him use language. I think the three people that have affected me most are Shakespeare, Mark Twain, and Gene Shepherd,
mm-hmm.
Just in the use of language. And also for a 14-year-old, he was so incredibly liberating. It was this kind of social, anti-social thread that he wove. And I had a personal experience with Shepherd. Eugene, first of all, thank you for the book. And I knew it was coming because I got an email from a friend back in Princeton who was the university professor in urban policy at Rutgers, a roommate of mine from college. He said, I've been listening to a radio interview with Eugene Bergman, who has written a book on Shep called Excelsior, You Fathead, Sounds Good, I'm ordering it. So you know that you've sold at least one in Princeton there and another one here in Wilmette. But I met Shepherd. He had a sponsor, Jerevienne Perfume. And I guess I had a first girlfriend then, and Shepherd said that anybody who comes to one of the department stores, either Lord & Taylor or Saks in New York, and spots him and goes up and says, not Excelsior, you fathead, but Excelsior baby, because he used to say Excelsior baby a lot. He'll give you a flacon, and I love the way he pronounced that, a flacon of Jerevienne. And so I had been working for my dad down in the tip of New York. I think I was 16 years old. It was on a summer. And I said, I'm leaving, and I took the subway up, and I go in, and I go to the perfume department, and that 16-year-old feels pretty self-conscious. And I look around to see if there's anybody who looks like Shepherd, because I had no idea what he looked like. And that was the other thing that was magical, is that radio gave you this voice, but you had to fill in the face and the body. But I saw this presence that had to be Shepherd, because he was kind of glowing. And in a very sheepish way, and I remember just feeling so embarrassed, but yet I wasn't going to let this magical opportunity pass. And I walked up and I looked up and he seemed like about 100 feet tall. And I said, excuse me, are you Mr. Shepherd? And he said, and of course, in his typical, yeah, kid. And I said, Excelsior, baby. And he said, okay, kid. And he reached in his pocket and pulled out this little black hole of Jerevienne. And life has never been the same. So thank you for the clips. My university friend sent me the Flick Lives website. And just tonight, reconnecting, I'm 63 now, reconnecting with that voice and those images, it's like a constant in a lot of our lives. And thanks, Milt, for
it. My pleasure. Great to hear from you, Barry. And we've got one more fine clip coming before we're done tonight.
Well, I will not turn it off. And, Eugene, uh-huh. I will buy your book. thank you for doing it.
Thank you. Great to hear from you.
Nice speaking to you, Milt.
Good night.
Take care. Bye.
All right, quickly, to another. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes. I met
Sentinel I met, I was introduced to Gene Shepherd as a kid in Ohio. His short stories actually appeared in Playboy in the mid-50s, late-50s. And I just loved them. And then had the opportunity to move to New York and sell print advertising in New Jersey. So I drove around a lot, and I used to listen to them every night. There were times I would sit out in front of my home in Princeton, New Jersey, just waiting for the show to end, which pleased my wife no end. But the thing I want to mention, at WOR, which was just a marvelous radio station, drive time from 3 to 6 was Bob and Ray, Bob Elliott and Ray Gould.
Yeah.
And Arlene Francis had a show, and there was a guy there named William B. Williams, who was sort of an impresario, a great friend of Frank Sinatra. And WOR's format just stayed with me all day, because obviously I was driving from New York to Baltimore, and I just couldn't get enough of it. His show was just marvelous, and the radio station itself was one of the absolute best radio stations in the country at the time.
Do they still do talk radio, basically, on WOR?
Yeah. I think they do a lot of sports.
They
do a lot of sports.
Yeah, used to do.
But they do some more sport than they ever did then.
But there's never been somebody to match or replace Shepard.
Oh, no. Bob and Ray weren't bad.
Oh, well, they were superb.
they were great.
They were, I would drive into the city and driving home. If I got home at 5 o'clock, or 5:30, I would drive around until they were over and then go home.
Well, what you say about sitting in the car rather than turning off a Shepard, I was a young assistant professor up in New Haven at Yale in those days, and I had the very same experience. I loved listening to him, and sometimes he would pin me to the car long after I finished my appointed chores.
My wife was not pleased.
Yeah. Thank you so much for the call.
You're welcome.
Delighted to hear from you. There's an interesting email that came in spontaneously, because I haven't invited email to that, I think. This fellow says, the clips you have aired have been upbeat with a heavy dose of sang-froid and laconic wit. Question, did Gene Shepherd have any Dark Nights of the Soul on the air, especially given the era during which he broadcast, an era of conflict, assassinations, the Cuban Missile Crisis, and so on, not to mention personal setbacks such as divorce? What might his show have been like on those dark nights?
One of the kinds of stories he told, which, of course, was also funny in its own way, was the story of two cavemen called Og and Charlie. And the one that I especially remember is one where at some point one of them goes and gathers up some clams, and they just sort of squat there by the side of the lake. And the other one slowly picks up a rock, because he wants the clams, and crashes it down on the head of the other one and kills him outright. And as Shepard said, modern man had begun. What a sad negative tone that one had. But yet he managed to tell it in an amusing and fascinating way. But there was that dark side of him also.
He was amused by the evil that lurks in the heart of man.
Yes, he believed that definitely that was a part. He would say that it's the fist fights that break out in all of us. And he felt that you never, ever get rid of that, because it was part of what human beings are. And that's one of the very negative things that he had to say. And yet the overall effect of his broadcast was one of great joy in life. But there was this other side, too, an undercurrent.
Well, if you look at human nature and the human history whole, you've got two choices, either cry or laugh rather than cry.
And definitely he would laugh. And one of the things that he said was that, one way of telling some of the sadness and the negative parts of human history is to do it in a funny way. And people think you're joking. Mm. And he said, I'm not joking. This sad part and this negative part is also true. I'm saying it in a funny way, but I'm not joking.
We are due for another quick stop for some commercials and right back to the phone on 591-7200.
What follows is the Model 720.
WGN Radio.
End user guidebook.
Something is fundamentally wrong, kid. Check the focus of your projector lens.
I wouldn't have said that.
Now, adjust the volume control so that the sound can be heard in all parts of the room.
What's that mythical Medusa in the Return of Stone?
Immediately following this announcement...
No, Medusa had a thousand things coming out with that.
You will see a flash and hear a beat.
And likewise turn to salt.
These should happen at the same time.
What else you got for me? So we're all hoping Charlotte really gets the same time this one.
Radio 720.
A something.
The preceding program has been...
prescribed and transcribed.
Well,
okay.
However you'd like to say it.
Let's try it again. WGN.
If you walk or run, if you hike or work out, if you play tennis or basketball,
get in to the N.
N is for fit. N is for performance.
N is for New Balance.
Find your N at New Balance North Shore in Highland Park. Over 200 styles for men, women, and kids. A huge inventory of hard-to-find sizes and widths. AA to 6E. Plus, a helpful staff that will fit you right.
Introducing the Model 766 running shoe. Picked by Runner's World Magazine as this season's best new stability shoe. The 766 is in stock now in a variety of colors and sizes for men, women, and kids.
N is for selection. N is for in stock.
N is for New Balance.
Find your N at the store with the best selection of New Balance shoes and apparel. New Balance North Shore in Port Clinton Square on Central Avenue in downtown Highland Park. Open 7 days, Sunday 11 to 4. See us on the web at nbshoes.com. Find your N at New Balance North Shore and achieve New Balance.
What's a million-dollar greenhouse located virtually anywhere in the continental U.S. could be yours for just $100? What if you won $800,000 cash? Interested? You have a 1 in 40 chance to win a prize. Yes, you heard it right. A 1 in 40 chance to win one of the 1,000 guaranteed prizes valued at over $1.5 million by entering the 14th House of Dreams charity raffle sponsored by the Naperville Rotary Charities. Buy additional tickets and you may win a Corvette or a Hummer, his and hers Rolex watches, a Harley Davidson Softail, a Mini Cooper convertible, or a Mustang coupe. Entrants must be 18 years or older. Winning tickets will be returned to each draw to win other prizes. Entry deadline is June 28th. Raffle money will go to global polio eradication. 70% of the 40,000 entries are sold. Act now. Don't be left out. And it is $100 using most credit cards. Call now at 1-800-CASTLE-2. That's 1-800-CASTLE-2. Or reach them online at 1-800-CASTLE-2.com.
Do you have tingling, burning, coldness, or numbness in your legs, feet, or hands? You have difficulty standing, sleeping at night, or balance problems? If so, please pay attention. I'm Dr. Gene Mary, a practicing neurologist for 25 years in Hinsdale, Illinois. During this time, I've treated thousands of patients for peripheral neuropathy symptomatically with medication. However, over the last 2 years, since I've been using the treatments of Premier Physical Therapy, I've seen considerable improvement in the vast majority of my patients, both symptomatically and functionally, a great improvement over a previous regimen. Premier Physical Therapy is a fine professional group that has done my patients a great service. I will continue to refer all of my neuropathy patients to Premier Physical Therapy into the foreseeable future.
The treatments at Premier Physical Therapy are clinically proven in managing both diabetic and non-diabetic neuropathy. Call Premier at 877-PT-NERVE to schedule a free consultation. In Hinsdale, Orland Park, Evergreen Park, and Bloomingdale, and a new location in Skokie. Call 877-PT-NERVE. That's 877-786-3783.
Hi, this is Joe Perillo with Perillo BMW in Chicago. Have you been noticing all the new BMWs driving around with Joe Perillo license plates on them? There's got to be a good reason, because, folks, everyone shops. We'd love a chance to invite you to our showroom at 1035 North Clark, or contact us at PerilloBMW.com. If you're not familiar with the new 2005 325, 5 Series, 4X model, we'd love a chance to show you. BMW Financial Services has special rates on all of these models. Thanks.
This is Extension 720. Once again, here's Milt Rosenberg.
And we return to Eugene B. Bergman, from whose new book we have been drawing, Excelsior Euphatig, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepherd. Applause Books, the publishers, available wherever they sell real books. And wonderful reading with great large swatches of monologue material directly taken from the tapes of Shepherd's broadcast. 591-7200 is our number. You are the next caller. Good evening.
Hello.
Yes.
I just wanted to say what an incredible moment it was tonight when I turned on my radio and I hear this voice saying, put your radio in the window,
uh-huh,
and hurling invectives. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, 40 years ago in New Jersey, I used to listen to Gene Shepherd. It sounds just like him.
Uh-huh.
And it is so wonderful. It's like re-meeting an old friend.
Mm-hmm.
I used to listen to him when I was about 15. It also was a time when I was becoming aware of politics, and things were changing, but he was an incredible storyteller and commentator. I think the way he worked with his timing and silences, there were moments that he would say something and then it would get quiet for just a moment, and even that would be funny sometimes, or that would be thought-provoking. So I just wanted to call and say thank you. Thank you for the web address and for letting us know that we can get his recordings and certainly your book, which is going to be, I'm going to get it as soon as I can. The other thing I wanted to say, and I don't know if the question was rhetorical or not, but you were talking about who else could do such a thing,
yeah,
tell these stories, and if this person goes in the right direction, I Steve Dahl, I think, is a very good storyteller. And could he sit for 45 minutes like Gene Shepherd used to? I don't know. But
remember, Shepherd did it alone. He didn't have any sidekicks,
right,
to talk with.
Exactly, exactly. And his stories, whether he was talking about what I thought were true stories about his family and the old man passing gas in the Buick, or his army stories, I mean, they were just absolutely fantastic. And it's the same, actually, that there aren't any radio reruns, because if there were, I would listen to them all the time.
Well, I wonder if there aren't. Thank you, ma'am, for the call. Does anyone rerun Shepherd? We had an email from somebody who tells me that on WFMT's Midnight Special program, when they do, I gather, a yearly program about the White Sox, they play a Gene Shepherd routine about the White Sox.
Well, not only that, but in New York, there's a program every week on WBAI-FM, and that's streamed on their website.
Uh-huh.
And the Flick Lives site archives the last roughly dozen of those. And there has been at least one Internet source that plays Shepherd 24 hours a day.
Really?
I do list them in the back of the book.
Yeah.
I haven't checked it out recently, but the last time I did, it was still there.
I want to play another soliloquy, another major piece, which we get, of course, from Gene Bergman. I listened to this earlier tonight, and I was delighted by it. And this is the one in which he reveals ultimately what he wants. And I'll let the audience discover that as we listen to this clip.
Yeah, what you do is you knit one first and then you purl two. And after that, you just sit down and wait for development. It's like opening up a box of one of these instant pudding mixes and so on. You always have the hope. It's a very fugitive, sneaking hope. It's a hope that you beat down with mental sticks and stones. A fugitive, sneaking hope that when you mix the water with it and mix the milk with it, that instead of pudding, something else will suddenly leap out of the bowl. A great hissing and bubbling. And, you know, oh boy, that immense feeling of power. That's what we want, power, all of us. Let's admit it, we want power. I admitted it last week. Somebody called up and said, what do you want, Shepherd? And I suddenly sat here for a moment and thought about it. What do I want? Once in a while, one has to face oneself clearly and distinctly. What do I want? And then I came to the answer that struck me like a thunderclap, a great cloud out of the west that rolled and hissed and steamed. I want everything. Everything. That's what I want. All the money, everything. I want everything. Everything. I want everything. All the women, everything. I want every radio show. I don't want anybody else to have any shows. I want every television show. Me, starring me. I want to do every show on Broadway. Well, and then I admitted it. And this guy called up again and says, "Oh, quit clowning around, Shepard. What do you really want?" And he couldn't face the fact that I had told him what I really wanted. You see, we keep ducking and bobbing behind this silly, shilly-shally facade of wishful dreams. Okay, you got it, there, right out in front of you now. And all its hairy virility, right out there. And you can't hide from it, ever, really. Did I ever tell you about this guy I knew who had a Model A? A Model A Ford. And he had it perfectly restored. It was a beautiful Model A Ford. Well, it was. It had a bad muffler. But it was a Model A Ford. And he had imitation snakeskin upholstery put in it. It was terrible. And he thought it was good. And I remember he drove this pretty little Model A Ford around. He said to me, "Isn't this great? Look at this imitation snakeskin upholstery." And all I could think of to say was, "Your muffler's bad." See, I couldn't face it either. Not the grim, shrill reality of life. Grim. Well, it's not so grim. Ever tell you about the time Charlie Grimm got mad and threw his banjo out of the third base dugout in Wrigley Field? And it went all the way out in the right center field. His banjo. It was a tenor banjo, I remember. And then Grimm saw this tenor banjo out in right center field, and he suddenly got panicky and realized that it was the only tenor banjo on the north side of Chicago. And it was his chief earned means of livelihood. And so he called time. And the umpire was about ready to throw him out of the park, you see, for what he had done. Charlie went up to him and said, "It slipped. I was just practicing a few swings in the dugout. It slipped." Well, actually, he was having a tantrum, but he wouldn't face up to it. He was having what we call in the business a banjo tantrum. Or it's known by the psychological...
That seems to have ended rather surprisingly.
It's interesting that particular clip was a very early one that I made in the 50s before I had a direct connection for my recording.
So you got the microphone right up against the radio.
Yes, and one could hear not only an airplane going overhead that Sunday night, but a little bit of the television being played two rooms away where my parents were watching it. So that they were the older generation watching television, and I was the kid back in the kitchen listening to Gene Shepard.
We'll go right back to the phone right after we take care of these messages.
How do people react when they get a 4-star hotel for a 2-star price on Hotwire.com? When they discover that Hotwire.com consistently beats other sites on hotels, let's find out.
Honey, I'm going to find a hotel in Boston for my family reunion.
All right.
Let's see. There's a 4-star hotel on Travelocity for $159 a night.
Ouch.
I don't think so. Orbit's $154. Mm. And on Hotwire, a 4-star hotel with a gym in Cambridge for, oh, honey, look at this, $104 a night.
$104 a night? Yes!
And now let's slow down the tape to more fully understand Bob's reaction.
$104 a night?
We saved enough for a big pet steak dinner and maybe even a new table saw. Why didn't I go to Hotwire sooner?
Yeah.
Ah, much clearer. Log on to Hotwire.com, spend less on hotels and more on power tools.
Based on February 2005 comparisons, not including taxes or fees, prices subject to change and availability.
Volunteers of America want you to know they're the best choice for donating your car, truck, or other vehicle. First, unlike others who want your donation, Volunteers of America operates its own car donation program. Second, they don't use a third-party fundraiser that keeps a portion of the proceeds, leaving only the leftover. With these facts, truly, more of your donation goes directly to help the abused and neglected children in your community. Join thousands of Americans each year who donate their cars, boats, motorcycles, and RVs and take advantage of the savings at tax time. Volunteers of America makes it easy, and your donation will make a difference in meeting the needs of the community. All you need is your vehicle title. Call 1-800-363-1129. Volunteers of America will arrange for free towing and will provide all the documents needed to receive your tax deduction. So if you have an old car and you need that tax deduction, call today. 1-800-363-1129. And Volunteers of America will do the rest. Volunteers of America has been helping the community for over 100 years. For more information, log on to carshelpingpeople.org. Are you threatened with nursing home expenses that could drain in months what took a lifetime to save? Are you losing sleep because a loved one does not qualify for Medicaid? The effects of long-term illness can be devastating, both emotionally and financially. Through no fault of your own, you risk the loss of your home, bank accounts, investments, life savings, virtually everything. Rick Law and the Medicaid Crisis Lawyers at Law Elder Law know the rules. They can help you with sound legal strategies for having the government pay for your loved one's long-term care without losing all of your assets. When long-term illness strikes a family, most don't know where to turn for the help they need. Before it's too late, call the Medicaid Crisis Lawyers to protect your family, your money, and regain your peace of mind. Call 800-810-3100. That's 800-810-3100. Or visit lawelderlaw.com. LAWELDERLAW.com.
We now return to Extension 720. Now, here's Milt Rosenberg.
Who asks, are you looking to buy a new car? Do you want to check the history of a used car? For either purpose, tune in tonight to Steve and Johnny. Get the answers you may be looking for. Their guests, Frank Pyler and Mark Billick of Consumer Guide Magazine, will be in studio to answer all of your car questions here on WGN Radio. And we go back to the phones. You are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening, Professor. Let me strip your memories gears a moment. Many years ago on WGN, your program was followed by a show hosted by Eddie Schwartz.
Chicago Eddie Schwartz.
You got it.
Absolutely.
I remember at least three or four occasions when Gene was on the on with Eddie.
I did not know that. How fascinating.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, both of them were ham radio operators.
Yeah.
And that connection, and as am I. And the local ham radio operators, generally on those nights, used to call in to needle both of them.
Was this when Shepard was living down in Florida?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Shepard would recall many of his memories a little more factually from his Chicago, Southside steel mills, Indiana days.
Yeah, I wonder if Ed has tapes of those. If so, they should be added certainly to the archival collection.
Like I say, it was on WGN. I don't know if your archives still have them or not.
Well, we could look into that. Our archive is like a great big Fibber McGee closet. But that's fascinating, and I might follow through on that further. Thank you, sir, for the call.
Yes, and one other thing.
Sure.
Every year there's a large ham radio convention in Dayton, Ohio, and for a number of years it's a banquet. Shepard would be the featured speaker. He would more or less alternate years between himself and then Roy Neal, the NBC News space correspondent reporter, would do alternate years with him.
Apparently there were three of those in which Shepard talked at the Hamvention. Two of them there are tapes of, and they're fairly regularly
available. The man
couldn't
get enough of radio, obviously.
Right, and of course he loved ham radio so much that he wanted to do whatever he could to help ham operators.
Uh-huh.
He even made a little tape on an introduction to Morse code, and he also did a little video on satellite communication of ham radio operators. So he was very into it.
He's got a very funny and classic routine on learning Morse code while in the Signal Corps.
Yes, a group of them who were in the Signal Corps, for some strange administrative error, were put in a primitive class in learning Morse code. So they were all experts, of course. So what they did was make believe that no matter how hard they tried, they couldn't even get to first base with Morse code. And, of course, it drove the instructor crazy.
Until Major Abramowitz came in and saw through them. I told them, you got that code, or what was it, or you're going to go to a radar unit.
Ah, right.
Let's work it. One or two more quick calls. Back to the listeners. Good evening, you're on the air.
Hi, I was a college student in 1953, and I'd listened late into the night to KYW in Philadelphia. I believe that was the station. And I was intrigued with Gene Shepard. His colorful words, his phrases, his imagination. You never knew what was coming up next. But there's one thing I'd like to ask. He, at that time, he played quite a bit of classical music, and he had some very unusual songs on there. Would your guest have any comments on the music that he played?
He, Shepard was quite an aficionado of classical music and also of jazz. And in the early days, he did play more extensive pieces of classical music, and he played much more adventuresome jazz. He would play some of the more avant-garde jazz pieces, but this was in his early days. And later on, he tended to play more Dixieland and funky, amusing, more easy to appreciate stuff. But in the early days, he played a lot more classical and far-out jazz.
Yeah, his music was wonderful on that. Do you recall he had a theme at that time that was very unusual? Would you know what that is?
Well, the theme that played at the beginning and end of virtually every program on WOR for 21 years is called Bon Fry, which means something to the effect of free course. And it was written by, as Shepard said, one of the lesser Strausses, Edward Strauss. And he played it because he felt it was such an intensely bad piece of music that, as he said, it set the tone for his program.
Thank you very much for your comments.
We thank you, sir, for the call.
Bye.
What can your book does deal with the decline of years, or the years beyond the active career? They weren't very fulfilling years, were they?
No, because despite the fact that he had many successes, that he was recognized as a great radio person, that he'd made films and written books that were very popular, and he had so many fans, he still felt that he should have gone further in the public imagination. And the fact that he didn't, he felt, was just not right. It was a failure somewhere along the line, whether it was of the American public, of I'm sure he realized he tried as hard as he could, but somehow it just didn't work out to his total satisfaction.
He was born in 1921. He died in 1999 at the age of 78.
Yes.
Two children surviving.
Yes, even though he at times would actually deny their existence.
Why would he do that?
One interpretation is that he seemed to always want to seem young and free and unencumbered by such mundane things as family. That's one interpretation that I've heard.
Some mystery clings to this stuff, so even despite your heavy research.
Yes.
But that the product of that fine research, Excelsior, Your Fat Head, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepard, is the book by Eugene Bergman. It's readily available, published by Applause Books. We'll end with Shepard, the musician. He would do this often. He would go along with his kazoo, accompanying other recorded music. And that's what we'll go out with this very night.
Play it out. Oh, by the way, I say by the way. Oh, by the way. When I meet, when I meet, when I meet. I'm a part of that.
ba, 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 ba. Yes, sir, that's my baby. No, sir, I don't mean maybe. Yes, sir, that's my baby now. Oh, baby, let's sing it out, King.